Attention to Crusaders. You are now listening to Vox Arcana, a production of Holosuite Media. By the will of the immortal Emperor of Mankind, it has been decreed that the following broadcast of Vox Arcana may not be suitable for all ages. The views expressed on this Voxcast are solely those of the individual providing them and do not represent the opinion of this station, website, or any affiliated partner. Audience discretion is advised.
Attention on the battle fleet. This is Captain Ramaskos of the Imperial Star Cruiser Vox Arcona. Please listen carefully to the following announcement.
In accordance with the Codex Astartes, we hope that you have a productive trip to Arcona and arrive with the will to deliver the Emperor's judgment. Thank you.
Greetings, cultists. Welcome to Vox Arcona, Mission 13, recording on Monday, August the 3rd, 2015, and coming to you from Subdeck 13, Primaris Deck, aboard the Battlefleet Charon. By the time you receive this transmission, I will be long gone. I am Alfarius, and I am pleased to share the fleet's Vox Relay with Alfarius. How you doing?
Greetings, Alfarius. How are you doing?
I'm not bad, Alfarius, thank you. Yes, if you haven't noticed, we are all Alfarius.
we are Alfarius. So we have oh my gosh, I'm sitting here looking at this and we have a lot of ground today. It's crazy.
Yeah, what a day to pick the Alpha Legion, huh?
Yeah, oh god, what a day. Well, let's get started, and we'll get started with what I think is the amazing feel-good. It's the feel-good piece of the week for me was the fifth State of the Crusade. It was by Brent.
Finally.
Yeah, and they're like, okay, now we're gonna tell you how this shit's gonna go down.
Yeah, exactly.
Except he said it all like corporate and polite, whereas we're just Vox Arcona. Each map. Okay, so right now we're set up to do map to do map based play, which good for us. And I have my thoughts, and I'll cover that in a second. I don't know why I'm yawning at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Anyway, I'm like, you're the one who should be constantly just like, oh my god, I'm tired. But like, it's like 5 o'clock here in the afternoon. I've been in air conditioning all day. I don't know why I'm sitting here going like, oh my god, I want to go to sleep. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so State of the Crusade 5, written by Brent. He talks about the kind of five steps of each match that's going to happen. So a fight concludes on in a war zone, in an outpost, and the fight goes to the command phase, which, by the way, we're going to cover this in really big broad strokes. If you want the full thing, go to the Eternal Crusade website, look at the fifth State of the Crusade. There's a really amazing map that makes me so stoked and ready to play this game.
Yeah.
I have to put in the obligatory Matt's ready to play this game now. so,
plus, those guys can explain it a lot better than we could anyway.
Yeah, so. Because they're the guys that are designing it.
Yeah.
So the thing is this, once a fight resolves in a zone, we're going to say Manufactorum Steve. Okay. Once the fight resolves in Manufactorum Steve, the points are attributed, the map flips, whatever, and then Manufactorum Steve goes into the command phase, where the first two factions who are eligible to do so put their thumbs on Manufactorum Steve and say, we want to fight there. First two to do that, it locks that in, that those are the two factions fighting for Manufactorum Steve, and we move on to the assignment phase, where a bunch of people from both of those factions jump in and say, I want to fight at Manufactorum Steve. And
these are the warlords, aren't they?
These are, well, no, the commanders are the guys that put their thumbs down. The warlords are the guys that put their thumbs down on the base and say, this is, we're fighting there. The assignment phase is individuals who are prepped for deployment get to jump in and say, I want to play this map. I want to play this fight. Once they've reached a certain critical mass of troopers, we move to the setup phase where everybody picks their deployment, picks what they want to do, squads are divvied up or whatever, and then you go into the actual game, you play through the round, and then the game resolves, and at that point it figures up territory control and things like that, and then it reverts back to the command phase so people can continue to engage in that fight.
What I found quite interesting about the setup phase is it also says there this is an opportunity for each side to strategize and coordinate. Squads are assigned while the warlord picks his powers and sets waypoints for each group.
Right.
I'm wondering what sort of powers the warlords would have.
Well, they have talked about the fact that, what is it, that basically, like, say I'm an Imperial Fist or whatever, think of it like command doctrines. In what is it, last edition of the Space Marine Handbook, where every Marine does their job, but like Guard or Iron Fist or Imperial Fists are going to be like, okay, we're going to have our siege vehicles and we're going to go beat the hell out of doors. So the Warlord may pick specific, like fighting in a Manufactorum, there may be a lot of close quarters fighting. So maybe the Warlord wants to pick something that helps out his unit or his army. In close quarters combat, as opposed to say a more wide open map where you fight, where you're going to want long guns, you know, long arms and vehicles and stuff like that. So this is the, based on what map I'm fighting, this is, you know what this is? Okay. Let me break this down for the 40K neckbeards out there. The command phase is me and Gig saying, hey, you want to play a game of 40K? The assignment phase is me saying, you know what, I'm going to play, or well, the command phase is us going, hey, you want to play 40K? Cool. Well, I'll play X faction and you play X faction. Cool. Then the assignment phase is us drawing up our army lists, right?
Mm.
Okay. I want some tactical guy. I'm going to have The setup phase is rolling for war gear, rolling for psyker powers. In the case of basic Marines, you're setting up your specific war gear in the squads or whatever. And then the game is playing
zones.
And then the game is playing the game, and the resolution phase is when you sit around bullshitting afterwards and you don't you sit around bullshitting afterwards and you don't pick up your models so the next guys can play on the board. You know?
And you sit there complaining about, oh no, I took that. No,
man,
I
had that. Man, how many victory points was this? Yeah. I think they need to add in that phase, the bitch about the game phase. But no, basically, that's kind of the design flow, which, here's the thing, and I don't know that I've mentioned it here, but I really, whenever I play a game, any game, tabletop role-playing game, miniature game, card game, whatever, I want the rule set to further my immersion in what I'm doing. Right?
Very much so.
And as much as I would love a planet side clone, you know, like seriously, here's the deal. Seriously, I would have been happy with a planet side reskin. Like maybe.
Yeah.
Of course, Nathan and Katie and everybody, they're going to hear that and they're going to be like, oh my God, why didn't we just do that? You know, why are we killing ourselves?
So much time and money.
Right. Why are we killing ourselves when we could just steal the tech from Daybreak, you know? But looking, here's the thing, and maybe this is going to label me as a Kool-Aid drinker, and maybe this is going to, first off, if I already haven't been labeled as a Kool-Aid drinker right now, there's problems. But, but here's the deal. Seeing a map campaign and seeing this phase system in place, you know, I'm really not overly, I would not be unhappy if this is where it stopped. You know what I'm saying? Like, clearly I want multiple factions, and I would like to have more area to play across, but like, this is a cool, like, it matches 40K. Like, I don't want to spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars on miniatures and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars on books and all this other nonsense. Now, that being said, I'm going to, like, once Eternal Crusade gets going and I know that the EC store is going to work out really well, I'm probably going to subscribe in addition to being a captain and blah, 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 blah. But, after we're done, I have to get your email because I've got it. I've got your captain upgrade sitting in my inventory on the EC site, and I will make sure that you are a captain, sir, by the end of today.
And David Ozy.
Right. I owe you. I made that promise, and I owe it to you, so I'm making it happen. I just think that this fits 40K, but at the same time, I'm still going to get my shooter play in.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I really, really want the planet side to run around with my squads and shoot up the whole place. But if this is what we saw, you know, if this is what could be realized, so long as we, you know, maintain true to the IP and we preserve the experience, I think I'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I can see that. I'm looking at the State of Crusade letter, and to be honest, it looks very complete is the word I would use to describe it. It looks like they've got everything, you know, set up the way they want it and ready to go, basically. And I'd be quite happy if it stays this way. It's a good way to start, and it's a good way to get those people that know the IP involved in the design process.
Right. So, but they also cover in here. They also cover, for example, the idea of campaigns. So territory control is a means to an end. This quote from the thing. Territory control is just a means to an end, as there is no reward for holding all the territories. Instead, the focus is on advancing your faction's progress in the current campaign. Campaigns occur regularly for a week at a time, with both ongoing dynamic events as well as scheduled ones. Each faction has your own set of objectives for the campaign. Factions with lower populations may see fewer or simpler objectives. At the end of the campaign, you're judged by the objectives you completed compared to those you were given. No one faction ever wins a campaign. Which, I sort of get this, because we have one of the other games I play casually with my family is Helldivers on the PlayStation. And the issue is, you complete a campaign, and then they just reset the map and you start all over again. Or in, like, the case of Planet Side, where you've got multiple factions, or multiple continents, if one faction can cap an entire continent, it locks it out for so many hours. Well, right now, we only have one continent, so if Space Marines decide to go steamroll the entire continent, then Malkadia it's just over, done. That's not an Eternal Crusade. That's not an Eternal Crusade. That was just a couple minutes crusade.
That was like a week.
Right? So, what they're, you know, what they can do, and let me cover, because they talk about, okay, factions given objectives, etc., etc. Objectives can be related to a simple capture, but they can also fundamentally change how you play. For example, as an orc, you may have the objective to destroy Imperial Relay Towers. Space Marine faction will have an opposing objective, and dynamic battles will pop up all over the continent for orcs and marines to participate in, with a completely different rule set tied to the new theme. So, like, orcs may want to destroy relay towers, marines may need to preserve, defend relay towers. There may pop up opportunities on a map for orcs to deviate from whatever they're doing to go and complete this thing to help out the campaign's overall objective. My issue with the campaign system and the objective system is, other than giving us something to do, what is the point? You know? Here's the deal. Like, what I would like to see from this, what I would like to see emerge from this on the macro scale, right, is each objective completed, you know, each objective completed pushes your advancement in the campaign. At the end of a campaign, it says no one faction ever wins a campaign, but the thing is this, like, if the Loyalist Marines have 20 objectives over the course of a campaign and we achieve 18 of them and nobody else really achieves more than about 10 to 12 of them, doesn't that mean we've accomplished more than they have? Isn't that a win? You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, I suppose what they're getting at there is that a win, quote-unquote, would signal the end of, like, the campaign. And obviously this is Eternal Crusade. The idea is that it's going to continue on for as long as they want to continue making money out of it. So, I mean, technically, no one is ever winning, as in, you know, no one can ever win an MMO. World of Warcraft, you know, whatever you do, you're not going to win the game. You can't win the game.
Says you!
I think that's what they're getting at, is that no faction is ever going to, quote-unquote, win.
Well, but here's the deal. I mean, if I put enough bullets in enough people, they're going to, you know, I'm going to end up capturing more, destroying more, taking more bases, capturing more maps, and the question that arises at that point, I mean, granted, that would be my definition of winning, so I mean, in that sense, I win, because I'm shooting more people, whereas somebody else, just playing as a Space Marine, maybe their definition of winning, I mean, hell, really, like, realistically, with my kill-death ratio in most shooter games, the fact that I don't die is me winning. But what I'm trying to say is that, like, at the end of the day, like, I get that they want the game to be fun, and I get that, I get that they want everybody to feel like they're making their own progress and enjoying themselves. But the problem is this: at the end of the day, if I put more bullets into somebody else, then, like, I kind of want something for that. And yeah, there's a progression system and it's coming, but I don't like the idea that, okay, well, there's these campaigns that we run, but you're not actually winning, right?
Well, no, you're doing better than the other people. It doesn't necessarily mean you've won,
yeah.
Because, well, a win signals the end of the conflict.
Well, the thing is this, though. What they say is that campaigns will occur regularly for a week at a time. You know, and then and then people can play whatever, and then the next campaign will start. But the problem is this: like, if I'm gonna play for a week, and that's the campaign, and then another campaign starts, then, like, if I ended up at the top of the standings, like, I want something for that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, I
want something to say that I ended up at the top of the standings, and effectively that's a quote-unquote win, right?
Well, technically, yes, but then, I mean, I'm sure you would get something for that, but the idea, and I think they have mentioned this before in the past, is that at the end of a current running campaign, the faction that is doing better will get a bonus in the next campaign. And that's the idea behind, you know, no one ever wins a campaign, because you're just doing better than the other ones, and you'll get a bonus in the next one.
Right.
At least that's the way I see it.
Well, we'll see how that plays. So from there, we go to Into the Warp 28, which had Katie, Brent, and Noah, and then Noah switched out for Nathan, and then Nathan switched out for Alexi.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, musical chairs. Do. couple of things. First off, the experience system is now working and it's in the game, although it just shows up as text in a corner of the screen.
Yeah, it's just a little bug report thing in the corner, isn't it?
Yep. XP currently for kills, assists, capture points, etc. They've been retuning the cover system so that it's now acceleration-based cover. So you'll only enter cover if you are moving towards the cover and contact the cover. Mm-hmm. And it's more indicative of what a player would probably be trying to do, as opposed to getting up to a wall and then snapping to cover.
Yeah, I mean, it does still look a little bit sticky with the Assault Marine, but...
Okay, well, that's because you're using... First off, you're using a giant-ass... Like, you've got a giant-ass backpack. But also, you're running into a situation where... with the backpack... The problem is this. Space Marines aren't supposed to be using cover. Like, their armor protects them. That's the thing, right? They don't have to use cover, you know?
But it helps.
But yeah, I understand. No, trust me. I've been in a situation where I'm about to get hit by a las gun, so what I do is I put myself inside a bunker as a Marine so that my 3-plus armor save turns into a 3-plus cover save, and I can make it versus the las gun, yeah. The las cannon. But that being said, or hell, even turning a 3-plus armor save into a 4-plus cover save, that's still a cover save, and I can still make it. But what I'm saying is, like, you first off, as an assault marine, you should be using the fact that you can get over a wall as your cover.
It's true. You know?
I just don't want it to look weird if they try to implement cover with an assault pack and you're, like, hunched over like the Hunchback of Notre Dame or whatever. The jump pack, they showed Raptors wall clinging. You'll hold for a short bit, but you'll also be able to equip an accessory that'll let you hold for a while longer. Almost as long as you want. Well, they said this specifically for Raptors.
Yeah. It's a shame that Lawless won't get a similar thing.
Well, it's not my fault that Gulliman came in and said, well, you really can't use all these terror tactic things.
Yes, it is your fault. You're an Imperial Fist.
It's not my fault. Gulliman is not my fault. Anyway, vehicles and hit locations, they've been retooling that. As of right now, rear armor does about double damage. The other thing is that they go into... then we move into the Q&A. And the Q&A, a lot of it ended up being rehash stuff.
They went into it very quickly this week. There was very little in terms of the production update.
Yeah, very little in terms of the production update, because they showed it and then they got into game. And first off, I don't know whether anybody else noticed this, but they did a graphic patch, or graphic pass, over the map, and it looks amazing again. You know, even more so.
Totally.
So we will run down this Q&A pretty quick. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk about. And there's some repetition in our show notes here because of questions that got asked multiple times. So Q&A, when can I play? Soon. Will there be Windows 10 compatibility? They have a system in the studio that runs Windows 10, so the game will be compatible. Will there be DirectX 12 compatibility? They are working on utilizing DirectX 12 with Unreal 4. Will physics be added to vehicle wrecks and dead bodies? Nathan said in most MMO shooters, it's a big and expensive thing to add physics in. They debated, but it'll probably not be implemented in a global sense of everything having physics applied to it. Just because it's entirely too much stuff to track in the game.
Yeah.
This game's already kind of a resource hog. Just me saying that, because it's really high specs for a game.
True.
Will we be able to use destroyed vehicles as cover? The answer is no. Yes, it's a tabletop thing, but no, it starts putting in variables that they don't want to work with.
Gigabyte, no light, bad medicine.
Sorry. let's see, the obligatory Xenos stream questions. Katie said that Eldar content is assembled, and they are looking to do that this coming week. Orc content is still being worked on, and will be in a future thing all to itself. Basically, what they've been saying is they want to put together an entire Eldar stream, not just a little bits and pieces here. What I'm happy about with this news is that if they are already turning their attention, their development attention, to the Eldar and the Orcs, that means that they are effectively done with the Chaos and Loyalist development.
And the Buffalo should be facing south very soon.
Buffalo facing south. So will there be Mac and Linux clients? Yes, but not for initial Founder access. They are working to have Mac and Linux compatibility, but right now this goes back to the design logic of let's have a stable game and then add toys.
And so, I have to say, good luck to the team on getting a Mac client out there. There hasn't been that many MMOs that have managed that.
iMarine. Anyway. let's see. In a future Twitch, will you do a cooking show? And they said, yeah, sure. Will you be able to earn rogue trader points for completing objectives and such? Nathan said yes, but they want it to be achievable but not farmable. Because they actually want rogue trader points to be worth cash. So like maybe at the end of a campaign, you might get rogue trader points for being on the right faction and winning the map. But they don't want it to be something like kill 20 people, get a rogue trader point. You know,
well, that's good. That's good to know as well, because it means that those people that choose to stay as free to war can choose to stay that way and still, you know, still get.
And they'll be able, well, they'll be able to get their flash. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
You know, you war, you knock out a couple of, you knock out enough rogue trader points to pick up, you know, your new shiny crack shooter. You know,
That's right.
Let's see. Are in-universe holiday-themed events possible? Well, they said that they first have to find 40k appropriate holidays. Obviously, there's not a Christmas anymore. Obviously, there's not, you know, there's not your standard Terran holidays.
All they need to do is ask the community. They'll be able to tell them. We'll come up with something.
I'm convinced that Brent has enough 40k lore that, and you know, it wouldn't turn up too much issue to do a web search for 40k holidays. But the other problem is the galaxy is so freaking huge.
True.
Like Arcona will probably have specific holidays, you know. Like Arcona will probably have specific global holidays because they were an imperial planet before the invasion. But you're not going to see, like you said, Christmas, Valentine's Day, all that other stuff.
They might have Cornmas, though.
However, the discussions will begin with Cornmas. I don't want to see that tree. Like, I don't want to see that tree.
I do.
Will new expansions be tied to in-game events? Like, you know, if they release the Tau, is there going to be, like, the month of Tau, where Tau do all the Tau things with the Tau because you like Tau? you know? They said that each expansion will be themed, and they're going to work on it from that avenue. Which I get it. Like, if you're releasing an air superiority expansion, you're going to try to release for everybody.
Yeah.
Which is better than what Games Workshop does. It's weird.
Just a bit.
Look, that's honestly, it's one of the things that took me away from 40K and brought me to War Machine, is that whenever War Machine does an expansion of the game, they expand all factions at the same time.
That's right.
Whereas 40K, they're going to expand Space Marines, and then at some point they'll expand Orcs, and then at some point they'll expand this other faction. You see what I'm saying? Whereas, you know, other games, they will, if they expand once, they're going to expand all the factions equally and let you sort it all out. Let's see, what is the status on Space Wolf beards? They are working currently on having most of the Space Wolves not wear helmets at all. So that's a good thing for, is that good medicine, Darren?
Beards! We like beards.
Beer. Wait, no, beards.
and beer.
Right. So, the video question from last week got finally played this week. Questions came up about, a bunch of these questions were already answered, like whether or not it'll be on the Mac, whether you'll be able to play with a gamepad on the Mac, what kind of will there be sub-faction bonuses? We've all covered that all before. Cross-faction PvE, they said they're working on that. They talked about whether the design architecture has been considered using regarding bikes. They said that they'll also be working on that as well. Everything's kind of being taken into consideration as they're building things. He asked about skimmers. They specifically said that they're going to function similar to the Covenant vehicles in Halo, which are more fragile or more agile, but more fragile. So do the Covenant vehicles work the way that I've been talking about
pretty much.
Mag Rider, where like I can strafe sideways with them?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep. Okay.
There isn't
good.
That much
I'm
difference
happy.
There.
He asked whether Eldar were going to be skill based or whether there were going to be buffs in place to make the Eldar feel different. Alexei said that the point at this point is to make all of Eternal Crusade be skill based. So there may be some there's going to be maybe a little more trick play involved with Eldar, but it's going to still be skill-based to convey the effect. You know, you're still going to have your war gear carrying a couple of different things for you. Finally, and this was sort of a fun question, the Ulthway craft world for the Eldar tends to rely very heavily on their guardians. But guardians are not actually featured or part of Eternal Crusade. The discussion there is that the situation on Arcona is so dire that you couldn't use guardians. And besides, in most places, as you know, I've been an Eldar player before, in most places, guardians are a defense force, whereas your aspect temples and stuff are your more offensive mainline fighters. So instead of guardians, you'll see dire avengers, because those are the warriors of... Those are the infantry warriors of the Eldar, not the guardians.
Guardians, aren't they? They're the elite guardians. Although,
well, they're the people. Well, the thing is this: the guardians. The thing about the guardians, as I recall Eldar lore, and I hope someone's listening to me to either email voxarcona@gmail.com and correct me, or go, no, you're dead on. Everyone is trained to be a guardian. They're like the National Guard, the mm-hmm. Eldar, or the Imperial Planetary Defense Force. They're just, if there's trouble, you put on armor, you go out, you defend the craft world. Those people who have decided to make the survival of the Eldar race their personal responsibility, those are the Dire Avengers. Those are the guys who have dedicated themselves to fighting, to war. And then the Aspect Temples are dedicated to specific types of war. That's the way I've understood the Eldar structure, and that's
yes
the way.
And
I,
no.
Well, yeah, yes and no.
Because the Dire Avengers are still a path of the warrior. They're still an Aspect Temple. They still represent an aspect of Cain and Menchikane. The Guardians are part of the Eldar path. They are, like you say, everyone is trained to be a guardian. Everyone is trained in weapons use and what's the word? Maintenance, that's the word.
Right.
However,
they learn how to fix their own guns.
Yes. However, Guardians aren't used as exclusively a defensive force. They're used as your main firing line, whereas your Dire Avengers, which are smaller in number, by the way, despite what EC is doing with their Aspect Temples. The Aspect Temples are exceedingly small in number because very few want to get caught up on that path. And very few want to dedicate themselves to murder and war, which is part of what caused the downfall of the Elder Society in the first place. In fact, most Eldar want to dedicate themselves to artisan and things like this. So, the Guardians tend to make up the bulk of any army that is sent out. Your Aspect Warriors are your elite troops. They are specialized in a particular form of warfare.
Okay.
So see, it would make sense to use Guardians.
Yeah, except for the fact that Guardians deploy in 20-man squads. Or 30, yeah. Or whatever, with platforms and stuff. Yeah, but Blood Claws? Yeah, no, they're just misguided Marines. That's fine. Technically, so does Chaos.
Yeah.
Chaos can deploy in 20.
That's true.
But that's because they don't get No Fear. Anyway, question came up about a Twitch dedicated specifically to game sounds, and they said that they're planning on having the sound designer and the game composer. I'm just yawning up storm, man. It's crazy. Anyway, we'll have a Twitch soon with the sound designer and the game composer on, and the game composer hasn't even been revealed yet, so I'm pretty sure...
That'll be very interesting to see, I have to admit.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that the moment I find out who the composer is, I'm going to rush off to iTunes and find his discography
exactly.
And start, like, downloading, because I love the music so far that I've been hearing on the Twitch.
And also we can put
Twitch
it in the background of the show.
With permission, of course, yes.
Of course.
So there was a question about shields, whether or not there'll be different changes and, you know, different kinds of shields, and of course that's gonna happen. But also, shields will be able to enter a guard position. The current plan is to use the gun button to shield, because normally equipping a shield removes your pistol or gun, which is fine, because if you're going to be running Power Sword or Thunder Hammer or something, then you're going to have a Storm Shield.
Yeah.
Question came up about keybind changes. They said eventually yes, but not for Founder Access. Right now, we're making sure things work right. That's the thing. Like, Behavior's making sure things work right. The captains will, you know, the captains will test all this, tune this all up, and we go from there. Another question came up about rhino spawning. You'll only be able to spawn at squad-specific rhinos, which is a departure for those of you that are Planetside fans. It's a departure from Planetside, because at Planetside you can deploy from any deployed Sunderer, whereas in EC you'll only be able to deploy from squad rhinos, which means you're going to have to make sure that your squad, that your rhinos are out there and potentially even protected.
Strategically parked.
Right. You will spawn into a seat of the rhino and can disembark from there, but it's not... but it's not like you don't have to stop. Unlike going back to Planetside, unlike Planetside, where you have to stop, deploy as a spawn point, and then people can spawn at you, you'll be able to spawn right into the rhino, and then you can deploy directly from the rhino.
You know what? With this rhino spawning thing, I've just suddenly thought, I have a horrible feeling that people are going to start forming up like rhino hunting squads. To go out good. Searching for these rhino spawn points.
Those are called Devastator squads.
Yeah. All right.
No, what I'm waiting
just
for
like specific squads just to go out and search for these things.
What I'm waiting for. Mm-hmm. No, but what I'm waiting for is a rhino with some kind of extra armor or whatever, and they come barreling into a base, and as they're barreling into the base, the entire squad deploys around the, you know. Like, pops from the rhino all at once. You know what I'm
That'd
saying?
That'd be good.
I think that would be kind of cool. There was a question based on Psyker powers being colorized based on God marks. So whether, like, Nurgle will turn out green and Zench will turn out pink and Slaanesh will turn out, I'm not entirely sure what color. The question is, or the answer was that they plan to colorize based on, they plan to colorize based on Psyker power. Which my dog agrees with. they plan to base on Psyker power group, not on Godmark. Question came up of... which I'm good with that. And so is my dog, apparently. So the question came up about the Rhino versus the Damocles command vehicle. They said that Rhino is going to be very squad specific. It's going to be bound to squad, that kind of deal. Whereas the Damocles is the. Give me one second. We ordered, for those of you at home, we ordered food delivery, so it's finally come in. So the Damocles command vehicle is more command. Rate version, which I'm guessing you'll be able to do command drops from there. You'll be able to spawn at the Damocles too once it gets back in.
Yeah, totally.
Question came up as vehicle spawning limits. They said it's partially limited by the map, because you're only going to be able to get in so many things. But also, the Warlord will have command powers that will be able to modify or alter that. So I'm guessing like Imperial Fists, Iron Warriors, your Siege guys are going to be able to spawn more Siege vehicles than most other units. Or whoever takes the Warlord power, you know, to do so, you know, your gear for a Siege, you're going to have more tanks and stuff. Let's see. Question came up about emotes, like dancing and blowing kisses at people and hugging people. They very specifically said no hugs. Maybe killy hugs or bloody hugs, but not hugs. the thing is this. The emotes that you see in most MMOs are completely antithetical to the property. I could see Marines making the Aquila. I could see, you know, Chaos doing some kind of chaos-y symbol. Orcs throwing the bird or something, I don't know. But I don't really see social emotes happening in this game, because that implies... Well, that's like, for the longest time, I had a problem running... I had a problem with the idea of doing a... Of a 40K MMO, specifically centered around Marines, because they're kind of programmed to behave a specific way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, a Marine deciding to, you know, go off and act sneaky and use contractions and, you know, behave in a way that besmirches the honor of the chapter. Like, I didn't really see that as being something possible. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think that most of your social emotes that you see in most games are going to hit the game. I would see maybe some directional emotes, like pointing at locations or whatever. If you want to get in on that role play of it, where like you're pointing at your eyes and you're pointing at a location or whatever. But really, at that point, you should be able to hit Q and mark that target. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It saves all the stupid emotes and the, you know, Macarena dancing and stuff.
Yeah, plus the last thing you want to see is a Space Marine popping the Gangnam Style, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Also, they asked, will bikes be able to make big jumps, pop wheelies, and drift? They stated that popping wheelies will expose the underside of the vehicle, which should have a higher armor rating, and you can use that to protect yourself versus incoming fire, which I thought was really cool. But other than that, like, it's a vehicle. It's still going to do certain things, you know what I'm saying?
It'd be really interesting to see if they allow certain armies, like, for instance, Dark Angels with Raven Guard. That'd be interesting to see if they could do like special maneuvers and things on that when they're on a bike and stuff like that.
I'm waiting for White Scars.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well, actually.
Right, White Scars, mounted combat, lots of wheelie popping, Mongol horde, biker jackets, and, you know, all that. Honestly, in terms of so that's Eternal Crusade, Into the Warp, whatnot. In terms of the larger 40K universe, Games Workshop's been deploying some new apps for you can read their books and buy their stuff from. No real video game news. The miniatures game, they're continuing to defile the fantasy line, and they're continuing to not do anything with the 40K line. And that, of course, brings us to the Imperial Data Slate, which we today will cover the Alpha Legion, Legio 20, in case you haven't guessed already.
Deep breath, everyone.
Right? Now, we are going to come across a number of things here. Also, you're going to get a lot of, well, nobody really knows whatever. That's because of some of the things that we're going to cover really early in the Legion's history.
Mm-hmm.
The Alpha Legion, Legio 20, their homeworld... No one knows. Pre-heresy or post-heresy, nobody really knows where the 20th came from. Their Primarch are the twins, Alpharius and Omegon, also referred to as Alpharius Omegon, although there is belief that the original Alpharius is dead.
And by the way, if you didn't catch it, that's Alpha and Omega, the beginning, yeah,
beginning
and the end.
So... I will cover us all the way up to the heresy itself, and then we can kind of play from there. The last legion created during the first founding, the 20th legion, work on the 20th began only a few decades before the discovery of their Primarch. However, other reports exist that the legion existed in a prototype form before that. Regardless, it seems that the legion was created in total secrecy by the Emperor. Information on the Legion's own gene seed was top secret. The designation for this mysterious special operations unit was simply Alpha. For reasons unknown, approval of the Alpha unit gene seed was denied by the Emperor, limiting the force to around 1,000 to 2,000 Legionnaires. Others speculate the Legion was deliberately preserved separately as an isolated unit by the Emperor for special gene seed augmentation in the future that no Space Marine Legion would ever end up undergoing. Reading this and reading some other stuff about who they are and kind of how they apply to the larger heresy, I think this might have been a proto Grey Knights.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is sort of laying the foundation for the Grey Knights, because they
were limited
very specifically. They were targeted for very specific work, and the Emperor refused to mess with their gene seed and wouldn't let them get very big.
Yeah.
Which tells me that he had built them very specific. He had task built them, not.
He had specific ideas for their creation.
Yeah. The Legion all but disappeared from Imperial records during the Crusade, coincidentally. But some reports of small Alpha units operating far from front lines do exist. These warriors were clearly Astartes, but carried no heraldry, and sometimes even operated under false flags of another Legion. The operations they undertook were usually assassination, subterfuge, espionage, sabotage, and recovery of artifacts. They also abducted important individuals from anti-imperial groups. They made it policy to never leave any witnesses. However, rumors still spread of a ghost legion. The force became known to bleed enemy forces through black ops and subterfuge before striking from 100 directions in a mass lightning attack known as the Harrowing. When Alpharius took command of the Legion, it was young, zealous, and completely committed to the Primarch's direction. Alpharius believed that secrecy and fluidity brought success, and taught his Legion to apply all such military techniques to both their training and operations. Legion's victory in the Great Crusade featured subterfuge, misdirection, rapid movement. Such victories required great skill and dedication, and the Alpha Legion quickly became insular and proud because, well, they could do it, nobody else could. It was their martial pride that led to a number of clashes with the other legions, primarily the Imperial Fists, the Ultramarines, the Death Guard. Also, the Night Lords called them sinners in a shroud of lies, which, coming from the Night Lords, holy crap. The Thousand Suns Legion discreetly shunned them and tried to avoid any contact. They did manage to have a couple of different legions that kind of dug what they were about. Among them, Horus and his Luna Wolves, because Horus buddied up to Alpharius really quickly. I could see that Horus and Alpharius's pride would jive together. Like, we are the best of the best of the best, oorah with honors. But also, the Dark Angels and the Iron Hands tended to work well with the Alpha Legion.
Oh, we know why the Dark Angels work well with them. They're secretive as it is.
Secret, sneaky, sneaky. Anyway.
But the Iron Hands, right?
The Iron Hands, we'll cover them eventually at some point, I guess, but there are things going on with the Iron Hands, obviously. But after Alpharius' disagreements with Gulamon, the Alpha Legion threw themselves even further into their preferred method of operation, largely cutting themselves off entirely from standard Imperial practices, orchestrating greater and greater victorious examples of their approach to the Crusade, even when more conventional attacks would have been more efficient. The most notorious example of this took place on the world of Testra Prime, where the Alpha Legion, instead of taking the opportunity to capture the capital and force the world's surrender, allowed the enemy to dig in and defend it so that they could then expertly take the defending forces apart in a number of different ways. After a week of suffering seemingly random mishaps as well as brutal ambushes, the defenders were forced to capitulate, having taken 90% casualties. When asked why the Legion had not taken the simpler strategy, Alpharius is reported to have replied that they avoided it as, quote, it would have been too easy. This campaign brought him censure from almost all of his brother Primarchs, except for Horus.
Of course.
Only Horus, impressed by Alpharius and his work, praised the Alpha Legion's skill. In the later later stages of the Great Crusade, the Alpha Legion withdrew into the empty space on the Imperium's frontiers, for reasons that we will cover shortly. So, which brings us to the Heresy, which is kind of like, there's this weird thing that starts happening with the Legion for some reason, which we'll cover later, but it really starts to happen during the Heresy. So did you want to cover the Heresy?
Certainly. So after the virus bombing of Istvan III, the presumed loyal Alpha Legion was one of the legions sent by the Emperor to destroy Horus at his base on Istvan V. Assigned to the second wave, the Legion instead turned on the loyalist first wave. It is thought that by many that much of the traitor's Istvan V strategy was planned by Alpharius and the Alpha Legion. When Raven Guard Commander Bran arrived at Istvan V, to retrieve several of what remained of the Lawless forces, including his Primarch Korax, the Alpha Legion tried to help Korax escape, going as far as killing the commander of the World Eater's battle barge, which could have delayed the superior Raven Guard fleet. The Alpha Legion had apothecary that were masters of face transplantation. They took the faces of fallen Raven Guard to transplant them on their own Astartes. Together with the knowledge gained by digesting the brains of the dead Raven Guard, three Alpha Legion Astartes were able to infiltrate the Raven Guard Legion. Later, about 50 Alpha Legion Astartes in the colors of the Raven Guard were sent as reinforcements for these agents. While Omegon could retrieve the data this infiltrators could obtain, all of them were killed by the Raven Guard. Learning of the infiltration of the Raven Guard, Horus ordered Ezekiel Abaddon to find Alpha Legion agents in his legion at all costs. During the heresy, the Alpha Legion split off from the main body of Horus's forces early and did not attack Terra, instead embarking upon a series of delaying actions in an attempt to hold Imperial reinforcements in place. A notable early example was attempting to block the White Scars at the Chondax system, but Jagatai Khan was able to maneuver out of their trap.
With a motorcycle.
They also engaged in smaller actions, defeating a White Scars force on Talarn and a Space Wolves unit at Yorant. Despite their contributions, however, Horus was defeated, of course, as we all well know.
So, in the aftermath of the heresy, the Alpha Legion didn't retreat to the Eye of Terror like the other traitors. Instead, they moved into the Galactic East, following new objectives of their own devising. Whether or not being brought to battle with the Ultramarines was one of the objectives is unknown, but it occurred all the same. On the world of Escrador, the Alpha Legion was assaulted by Ultramarines. Alpharius is reportedly happy with such development, as it allowed him to demonstrate the superiority of his flexible multitudinous and unexpected military strategies on the notoriously precise, methodical, and perhaps even moribund Ultramarines. However, the Alpha Legion Primarch was apparently taken by surprise when Gulliman departed from his own structures and led a surprise assault by his elite units on the Alpha Legion headquarters. In the resultant personal combat between Alpharius and Gulliman, it is believed that Alpharius was killed. The Alpha Legion responded, not by breaking and fleeing, as Gulliman predicted, but by turning on the Ultramarines' detachment and harrying them so mercilessly that by the time they had returned to the main body of the Ultramarine force, their casualties were almost total. The Ultramarines were driven from the planet in the subsequent battle. Following the battle on Escrador, the Alpha Legion fractured in order to hide from the Imperium. Small autonomous warbands were left in Imperial space where they set up secret bases in asteroid fields, space hulks, and barren worlds. These units launched frequent attacks against military targets that were weakened by the heresy and still posed a threat to ships, settlements, and garrisons. They further spread and coordinated chaos cults throughout the galaxy in order to instigate massive revolts against Imperial rule. These insurrections are often used to lure Imperial forces away from worlds they want to attack, paving the way for a large-scale assault from the Eye of Terror. Their role in spreading heretical cults has earned them the loathing of the Inquisition, which has devoted considerable resources in finding and destroying their secret bases. So far, the Alpha Legion has been declared wiped out by the High Lords of Terra no less than three times in M31, M32, and M39. These claims have always been disproved by the continued assaults of the Legion.
Lol.
Right. So the Astartes warrior cult, the Alpha Legion have a very specific thing, as you've guessed, their direction is special forces, black ops, and
subterfuge
and cult activities. There are a couple of issues that have popped up with all of this. They don't like direct combat. They use subterfuge, sabotage, brainwashing, multi-year plans to destroy their enemies as opposed to a simple head-on attack. The very identity of Alpha Legion Marines is subject to mystery because of some things that we are going to cover later. Due to shared aliases, members of the Legion often refer to themselves as part of the greater collective identity, i.e. We are Alpharius. Afterwards, whenever they do show themselves, they tend to prefer to let their cultists and underlings absorb most of the combat while they wait for the decisive moment to strike or escape, depending. Unlike most of the legions, they rarely operate within the Eye of Terror. As a result, they have not been subjected to the time distortion that the warp also gives other marines, which leads many in the Inquisition to debate how the Legion, now 10,000 years since the heresy, is still even active. According to Inquisitor Craven, the Alpha Legion acquires new recruits, genetically modifies them, trains them for missions all within the Imperial territory itself. Which there are things that we can talk about with that. So, the question becomes, like, this, just looking at the Alpha Legion as it stands, we have this creepy, spooky Black Ops unit that does weirdness and is kind of okay. So what really makes the Alpha Legion special? They're Marines, they're proud, but the two things, well, there's three things that really make them special. First thing is they're the only Legion to have two Primarchs, Alpharius and Omegon. Now, again, it's reported that the actual Alpharius is dead, which means that Omegon is now the Primarch. But we don't even know where he is or what's going on with him.
But then that also comes into the other thing of we are all Alpharius.
Yeah.
A lot of the Alpha Legion tend to look very similar. Right. They all take on the same kind of facial features and things like this. So there's no guarantee that Alpharius was the one that was killed.
Right. And that's the thing. We talked about that. They shave their head. They're typically taller than most Marines, which with that and their physical attributes, it makes them look sort of like they could have been a Primarch. They modify themselves as much as possible to look like each other, even down to cosmetic surgery and things like that, surgical alteration. So they... And, of course, when asked by non-Legion members, all Legionnaires say that they are Alpharius, even if more than one of them is present. Now, here's what really twists it. There is a very strong possibility that the Alpha Legion are still loyal and not actually Chaos. They're traitors, maybe, but not actually. They may be loyal. And that is because... with their martial pride and Alpharius' avoidance of all of his brothers, it's easy to see why the Alpha Legion sided with Horus when the War Master made his pact with Chaos. Horus loved him, nobody else did, so it sort of seemed fit that he kind of fit in with that. However, another reason, and this is covered in the book Legion, isn't it?
That's right.
Is that 2 years before the heresy starts, Alpharius Omegon is contacted by a Xenos organization known as the Cabal, which is basically kind of an overseeing organization looking after the greater betterment of the entire galaxy.
They're like a think tank of different alien races.
Right, they're a think tank of different alien races, and among them are a number of individuals such as the Perpetuals, basically people, typically humans, that will live forever.
I think there was only one, which was John Grammaticus.
John Grammaticus, but it's also hinted that the Emperor is a Perpetual.
Yeah, but he wasn't part of the Cabal.
Yeah, I'm talking about Perpetuals. There are Perpetuals in the galaxy.
Yeah.
John Grammaticus is specifically who approaches the Primarch and gives him visions of the heresy to come and predictions of the future. Those predictions are as follows. If the Emperor wins, humanity's existence will be ensured for 10 or 20,000 years of decay before they and the entire galaxy are consumed by chaos. The other one is that if Horus won, humanity would perish inside of 2 generations, but they would take the powers of chaos with them into oblivion and save the rest of the galaxy. And the Alpha Legion was asked to take on the greatest challenge, to defect to the side of Horus and make sure that Horus won. Because if they did, then again, humanity would die inside of 2 generations, but we would take chaos with us because our belief is sustaining chaos.
And chaos is so heavily invested in humanity at that point.
Right.
As well.
And if we all bought it at once, chaos would die too, and the entire universe would be safe. Apparently, Alpharius decided to agree to this and thus joined Chaos. Thus joined the war. But potentially there's conflict because they didn't throw themselves wholeheartedly into the fight. They just hamstrung. Well, the thing is this, though. They had to, they still had to operate, and this is why I think they were trying to do the right thing. They didn't go out to kill their brothers, right? They went out to hamstring them and waylay them and hold them up and make sure that they couldn't get to Terra so that Horus could do his job. Right?
That's right.
And had the Alpha Legion all decided to quit what they were doing and fight a straight-up frontal assault campaign, it would have thrown people off. And it would have gotten Horus like, what the hell's going on? Right? Because suddenly they would, what, throw their combat doctrine out the window? No.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't need to happen that way. So my guess is what was needing to happen, and again, this is all buried under the multitudinous misdirections of Alpharius, but my guess is that what happened is he agreed to join Chaos, he joined Chaos, helped with the Dropsite Massacre, and began to fight hamstringing campaigns all throughout the galaxy, and with the thought that after Horus killed the Emperor, right, after Horus killed the Emperor, then the Alpha Legion could kind of go back to what they were doing before.
Probably, yeah.
And be like, hey, look, no, this is what happened. The Cabal said this. We need to stick to this thing. Like, you know, now these things are going to happen, blah, 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 blah. Again, Alpharius is a sneaky guy. We don't really know. And the argument stands that even if the original intention were pure and loyal, after 10,000 years of chaos and dealing with everything that the Alpha Legion has dealt with for 20 years, you know, for the long war, you can't stay that close to chaos and not get tainted somehow. You see what I'm saying? So the logic goes, even if they might have started as loyalists, they probably haven't ended that way.
Well, the interesting thing about the Cabal and the Alpha Legion is that it depends on what sources you take as canon, because if the Alpha Legion were one of the first legions created, as we mentioned earlier, pre-heresy, then the Cabal's predictions may not be up to snuff, because the Cabal's prophecies never said it would be Horus and Alpharius. They just said it was the oldest and the youngest. And they interpreted the oldest as Horus and the youngest as Alpharius. So there's no guarantee that they've got the right people there. Alpharius, when he first heard about this prophecy, initially railed against it, because obviously it was completely against everything that he knew to be true. and he didn't want to be responsible for the death of the entire human race. So he pretty much beat the crap out of the Cabal representatives that he met with and left in a bit of a huff. Later on, obviously, he decided to join Chaos. And we don't know if he went along with the Cabal's predictions or whether he's had something else in mind. We don't know anything about that yet.
Right. So, I mean, that's what we're, you know, so we run into this, you know, are they, aren't they, what are they doing? You know, when GW decides to do an Age of Sigmar reboot for 40K, are the Alpha Legion going to come back and be like, no hard feelings, K?
You know? I do hope they choose to expand the background of the Alpha Legion, because they've got such an interesting story behind them, and everyone's waiting to see what happens with this Legion.
Well, I mean, that's certainly going to happen with the Horus Heresy novels, and maybe with the Heresy miniature game, but, you know, unfortunately we won't ever be able to see how it ends up. You know, we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
So that sort of wraps our show, really. All that's really left is the thought for the day. Did you want to... Yeah?
Yeah, there's a... I am Alpharius.
I am Alpharius.
We are...
We are all Alpharius.
Alpharius. And we
and
are
we
one.
Are one. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Adeptus Terra thanks you for tuning in to tonight's broadcast of Vox Arcana, a production of Holosuite Media. Be sure to check our website, iTunes, or Stitcher Satellite Radio for our remastered Voxcasts and more. You can follow us on Twitter at Vox Arcana. Or if you have any questions or comments, please send an email to voxarcona@gmail.com. Return next week for yet another communique from the Vox Arcana.